You're listening to the Brave Parent Podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Susan Maples. I'm here for all parents who deeply love their children and want their health span to equal their lifespan. In other words, to be healthy their entire lives. If that's you, tune in. In every episode, we're grappling with contemporary issues that affect every child every day in areas that your doctors either don't know or don't have time to tell you. It's your time to be brave. Hello, everyone. Welcome back to the Brave Parent Podcast, Season 2. And today we have a very, very exciting special guest, not only a friend of mine, but, you know, arguably one of my greatest teachers in life. When I first read Dr. Robert Lustig's first book, well, first big book that I knew of, Fat Chance, which was a bestseller, I was like, oh my gosh, who is this man? And I kept bugging him. I somehow got his email address through his university, and then I started writing articles and quoting him and sending him to him.
And I got a restraining order on
him. I know, right? I said, I know how to meet a rock star now. You just bug the shit out of him until they finally one day he calls me from the tarmac. My plane's about to take off, but I got another email from you. I think maybe we're supposed to talk. Like, oh my gosh. So that's how we put now. And then, of course, we've spoken together many times and many conferences. So I'm really, really blessed. This is a really special treat today. Rob is not only the author of Fat Chance, but of Hacking of the American Mind, which we're going to talk a little bit about hacking, I hope, and Metabolical, which is an incredible book that's his new release that I absolutely love. You guys who have read Brave Parent have no doubt heard me quoting Rob throughout the book. But also spent his life, his career, his great big brain in neuroendocrinology, which really is the study of the brain's connection to metabolic disease, the diseases of obesity, diabetes, metabolic disturbance of all kinds. And we're going to talk more about that in children. So pediatric neuroendocrinology, that means how is the brain connected to all this, and what is it that fuels our addiction and the problems that we see? Why are we fat, sick, and tired all the time? So, I don't know. You want to add to that, Rob?
I don't know. I'm fat, sick, and tired, so I'm
not. You are not.
I'm only kidding. The fact of the matter is that when I entered medical school, you know, there was like maybe one obese kid per class, and now it's half the class. And, you know, this happened on my watch. And, you know, I started out taking care of short kids, and then these short kids got fat on me. And, you know, the question was why? And of course, everybody, you know, would like to just, you know, say, well, you know, they're gluttons and sloths. You know, the problem with that argument is that we now have an entire pandemic, not epidemic, pandemic of obese newborns. South Great. Africa, Russia, Israel, United States, birth weight now, 25 years later, 200 grams more than it was 25 years ago. And when you do the DEXA scanning, the body compositional analysis on them, it's all fat. So Craziness. This is a setup.
Doomed from the start.
Doomed from the start. And the question is why? And so I have basically been on a quest for the last 40 years, really. I mean, 25 in reality, you know, to try to understand what's happened to us. And what I've come to realize is, yes, this is a function of our environment, that our behaviors, the gluttony and the sloth that we all attribute to the rise in obesity and diabetes, et cetera, is actually, they're just manifestations of the biochemical outcome. Changes.
Yeah.
Right. Okay. So this turns it on its head. So then the question, of course, is, well, what's the biochemistry? And there I actually am sort of uniquely qualified to be able to look into this question. And
in fact, if you're interested in the biochemistry of the sugar loop, look at Sugar, the Bitter Truth. One of his, I guess it was a lecture you gave to a bunch of students.
It went viral,
but how many millions of people have?
Right now, I think we're at 22 million views.
Yeah. So if you haven't seen that, even the first 15 minutes will blow your mind. So it's really worth seeing. It's an hour.
Yeah, I mean, I got to tell you, I mean, it's a 90-minute lecture in carbohydrate biochemistry. I didn't think my mother would watch it. And indeed, she did not. But 22 million people did. And I don't understand that. To this day, I still don't understand that. But people are clearly, you know, in air quotes, hungry, you know, for this information, because they understand, they recognize something is wrong. And Einstein's theory of insanity says, you know, doing the same thing over and over again and expecting a different result. Well, for the last 40 years, we've been doing the same thing over and over again, and we haven't gotten a different result. So, you know,
I often think of your work as sort of like Adam and Eve ate the apple from the tree, which was appropriate, but we really screwed it up when we took the sugar out of the apple and sprinkled it into everything, right? I mean, that's a man-made, you know,
pretty much
death sentence.
Yeah. So I'm gonna sort of, you know, bypass to the denouement, you know, just for your audience. Sugar is the payload. Ultra processed food is the vehicle. Ultra processed food's the bad guy, and it's everywhere, and it's 65% of the American diet, and 67% of kids' diets. And the reason ultra-processed food is bad is several-fold, but two big ones. Too much sugar, too little fiber. Too much sugar for palatability, because the food industry learned when they add it, you buy more. And too little fiber for shelf life, because you can't freeze fiber. Well, it turns out that fiber actually mitigated the effects of the sugar in, say, fruit. Because everybody always asks, well, what about fruit? Fruit's got sugar. Yeah, doesn't have that much, number one. And number two, it's got way more fiber than it does sugar. And the fiber acts as a gel, acts as a barrier on the inside of the intestine, preventing absorption. And so when you consume sugar in fruit, you are not feeding you. You are feeding your gut microbiome. You are feeding your bacteria, which you need to do. So eating a piece of fruit is good. On the other hand, drinking a glass of fruit juice is not. So that's what I mean by ultra processing. Even something as simple as, you know, smoothies, you know, take on an ominous tone when you realize what the biochemistry is.
Can you talk about the difference between processed and ultra processed food so people can really get that?
So my colleague, Dr. Carlos Montero, who's a professor of public health at the University of Sao Paulo, Brazil, came up with a classification system, which people are now using worldwide, and it seems to actually hold water, called the NOVA system. And what it says is that you can basically drop any food into one of four classes, class one through class four. So let's take an apple as, you know, sort of the prime example. Class one would be an apple, no change. Class two would be, say, apple slices, destemmed, deseeded, etc. Class three would be apple sauce. And class four would be a McDonald's apple pie. Okay?
Mm-hmm.
Four different iterations of the same basic food, but at four different processing levels. And what Carlos and many other investigators around the world have now shown is that it's the class four grouping that portends the metabolic detriments. That classes one through three are not the problem.
And one of the, I mean, I of course demonize sugar all over the book because I'm just, I cannot believe people aren't getting this. You know, the myth is that, especially for skinny kids, well, he should eat it now while he can get away with it and forget about the fact that we're training kids for the rest of their life in a very short window of time. We can talk about that. But you know, you and I spoke at a conference where I had you as a keynote, and the speaker just after or before you was really, really after the seed oils as the really big problem. Remember that? We had a little bit of a debate.
It was Chris Knobby from
Knobby, right? Yeah.
Texas, yep. San Antonio. And indeed, seed oils are not good. He's an ophthalmologist, and I believe that, you know, he's onto something, because seed oils are omega-6 fatty acids, and omega-6 fatty acids are the precursor to arachidonic acid, which is the precursor to all the inflammatory cytokines in our body, you know,
right.
whether it be prostaglandins, leukotrienes, etc.
IL-6, DNA.
Right. So there's no question that omega-6s are a bad guy in the story. And omega-3s are a good guy in the story. The problem is people think they're eating omega-3s when they're eating farmed fish. They're not. They're eating omega-6s because we feed the farmed fish corn, and the omega-6s are in the corn.
So a couple food sources for parents for kids of omega-3s are?
Fish, wild fish,
wild fish.
So there are three omega-3s, okay? And they have different purposes, and they have different destinations in the body. There's a vegetable omega-3 mm-hmm. called ALA, alpha-linolenic acid, okay? And you can get that in flax and grass and things, you know, some other foods, legumes. Now, that seems to have some benefits in terms of cardiovascular protection.
Mm-hmm.
And so I'm for them. But the other two are necessary for the brain. So one is called EPA, eicosapentaenoic acid. No one will be tested on this. One is called DHA, docohexaenoic acid. And these two are necessary for neural transmission and membrane stability. And it's been shown that if you're omega-3 deficient in either one, you know, you have a greater risk for both depression and Alzheimer's.
Well, and brain development in kids.
Absolutely. You know, we need these omega-3s, and they are essential. And the problem is, where do you get them? Well, turns out you get them from fish, but do the fish make the omega-3s? No.
No, they eat the seaweed.
The fish eat the omega-3s, right? Okay, the omega-3s are in the algae or in the seaweed. We, you know, so that fish eat the algae or seaweed, we eat the fish, we get our omega-3s third hand. But the alpha-linolenic acid in the flax gets converted to EPA and DHA unbelievably little. Okay, it's like 0.5%. It's not a good pathway. It's not a robust pathway. So I worry about kids who are, and adults for that matter, who, you know, are straight vegan, because they are not getting the EPA and DHA that they need. So they need to supplement, but the problem is the only supplement has DHA and not EPA. So even there, I'm a little worried.
And if we're looking at toxicology, just as long as we're mentioning fish, I always like to say the bigger the fish and the longer it lives, the less healthy it is in terms of mercury and toxins. So you want smaller fish like salmon and sardines,
mackerel, anchovies, these
right.
very little itty bitty fish.
Smash fish, right.
Because they're the algae consumers.
So, yeah.
You know, they're the ones you really want. But unfortunately, that's not the ones that are the big sellers in the store.
Right. The tuna, the swordfish, the great big sharks. Yeah. Mahi.
Right.
Those
and
are the ones
that's what's deeper. The, fish, yeah. the more likely there's some mercury contamination too.
We can go. I want to go back to sugar and brain training for kids. Lauren's got two little ones. And, you know, this is a very, how old are your kids, Lauren?
Yeah, 4 and 7.
4 and 7, this is brain training time. This is the time for the rest of their life to set up preferences. This morning I took a beach walk with a girlfriend who said, you know, I was lucky because my grandmother got breast cancer really young. She was in her 50s. I was like in the third or fourth grade. And she was literally the old fashioned, you know, had the bacon grease on the, you know, she was just and she decided to clean up her diet and get rid of sugar and survived. And remember, we didn't have mammograms that detected cancers when they were tiny back then. So, She said, I was raised really in a sugar-free home, which is why I probably don't like it now. I'm just not a big dessert eater. If you took chocolate out of my diet, it would take me a month to figure it out. So that's brain training. And every single young patient, I say, let's start with breakfast. I just want to know what you ate for breakfast. Because breakfast is cereal, it's Pop-Tarts, it's yogurt with sugar, it's sugar.
A word on bacon grease, okay?
Yeah.
Behind me, I don't know if you can see it, but behind me right there, there's a whole bunch of things on it right now, is a chair, okay? And that chair belonged to an Arctic explorer. In fact, he was a founder of the Explorers Club. His name was Vilhelmur Stefansson, okay? He was born in North Dakota of Icelandic parents. He didn't speak English until he was 17. And then he went to Harvard. And he was a founder of the Explorers Club in 1917. He actually trained the ski troops for America during World War II. There's a postage stamp of him. You know, he's like a mega, you know, star in the anthropological world. And he's the one who actually figured out that Eskimos didn't get cancer, and wrote a book called Cancer, a Disease of Civilization. Bottom line, he consumed a tablespoon of bacon grease every single morning.
But it wasn't cured.
It wasn't cured. That's right. It wasn't cured. So no nitrates. That's true. But bacon grease is not bad. People think, oh, you know, it's those saturated fats. Because we've been told for the last 40 years, that's that 50 years, that saturated fat is the bad guy. Turns out that was a put-up job by the food industry.
And well, coconut oil is all the rage, right? Coconut pulling, coconut this, that's saturated.
Well, it's saturated and also medium-chain triglycerides, both. But the bottom line is saturated fat is not the boogeyman. And it's taken us years to debunk all of the bad data that was accumulated and also all the propaganda. Now, it turns out the dairy industry has really been kind of, they've gotten a bad rep. And one reason is because, you know, they took dairy saturated fat and threw it in with red meat saturated fat. And turns out red meat saturated fat wasn't even the problem. Now, it is true that red meat is a consumption is associated with diabetes and cancer, but it's not the saturated fat. It might be the iron, because the iron's an oxidative stress. It might be the curing, the nitrates. It might be the fact that the red meat is very high in choline, and choline gets converted in your intestine by the bacteria to a compound called trimethylamine, which then becomes trimethylamine oxide in your liver, which is the stickiest substance in the human body and has been shown to be a primary driver of coronary plaques. So it is possible that red meat is not great for you, but it's not because of the saturated fat. And that's what we said it was. And then dairy got thrown in with the red meat, and that made dairy sort of the bad guy. Turns out dairy is actually protective against diabetes and cardiovascular disease.
You hear everyone saying, oh no, all dairy is inflammatory. I'm like, well,
you know, there's one study that says that dairy is inflammatory, and it is the China study. And the China study from Campbell and Eselstein. And I will tell you, that is
it's a big study.
That is 500 pages of single univariate correlation in a Chinese population that is not adapted to milk. So there is the possibility that maybe the Chinese have this problem, but this has not been seen in other populations. And you can't do a single univariate correlation analysis in something this complex as our diet.
I never really thought about that. I read the China study and Esselstein's work, you know, heart attack prevention, but I just never thought about that.
If you want a good takedown and a good debunking of the China study, go online and look at YouTube and look for Denise Menger, How to Talk to a Vegetarian.
Cool. Speaking of vegetarian, one of my kids who says, I'm vegetarian now, who's a cheer squad, I said, so what did you have for lunch today? Doritos and a Coke. So vegetarian doesn't mean healthy. Nope. She was being very honest with me. It's like, right. Oh my goodness.
Coke, Doritos and Oreos are all vegan. Mm-hmm. You know, so look, you can do a vegan diet wrong. You can do a vegetarian diet wrong. You can do a ketogenic diet wrong. You can do a carnivore diet wrong. You can do a Japanese diet wrong. You can do virtually any diet wrong if you're not paying attention. Now,
diets are very interesting to begin with because we're pathologic in our relationship to food. The fact that we need to try all these diets to lose weight rather than fix the root causes, which is to eat real food. And, right. You know, when you said, Rob, and I want to go back to brain training because I love the work of hacking of the American mind. When you said we add the food manufacturers add sugar because it's palatable, we'll eat more. That's not the whole truth. The added sugar on the food manufacturer's part does something else to our brain to get us to eat more. Can you talk about that?
Well, yeah. I mean, there's the area of our brain. It's right over here. It's called the nucleus accumbens. And the nucleus accumbens is our reward center. Okay. And the nucleus accumbens is where dopamine, the neurotransmitter, gets its signal transduced. So the dopamine cell bodies are in a different area called the ventral tegmental area further down the brainstem. But then they send the dopamine to this area of the nucleus accumbens. And those dopamine receptors in the nucleus accumbens transduce that signal and go, this feels good. I want more. Now, there are many things that stimulate that nucleus accumbens. There are chemicals and there are behaviors. So chemicals such as cocaine, heroin, nicotine, alcohol, sugar, and behaviors, shopping, gambling, social media, internet gaming, pornography. Each of those has been shown to stimulate the nucleus accumbens directly. And every single one of those 10 things that I just mentioned generate reward. But in the extreme, every single one of those generates addiction. There's an aholic after each one of those: shopaholic, sexaholic, chocoholic, alcoholic, etc. Okay. The point is that dopamine is the reward neurotransmitter. Dopamine says, I want more. The problem is that dopamine is excitatory. Dopamine excites the next neuron. Now, neurons want to be excited. That's why they have receptors. I mean, if they didn't want to be excited, they wouldn't have them, but they do. But they don't want to be excited nonstop. Okay. Neurons like to be tickled, not bludgeoned, is the way I like to describe it. Chronic overstimulation of any neuron anywhere in the brain, bar none, leads to neuronal cell death. Neurons are kind of fragile.
They're fussy.
That's right. They're kind of fussy. Right? Neurons don't like constant overstimulation. Now, when they do get overstimulated, they have a plan B. They have a defense mechanism. They have a way of trying to turn down the gain. What they do is they downregulate the receptor, so that there will be less of a chance that any given dopamine molecule will bind to its receptor and therefore not generate that signal. So what happens is the more you pleasure you seek, the more reward you seek, the more those receptors go down, and therefore the more unhappy you get because you can't transduce it. It's the law of diminishing returns. It's the phenomenon that we in science call tolerance. Okay, dopamine induces tolerance. All of those 10 stimuli that I just mentioned all induce tolerance. And then when the neurons actually do start to die, that's called addiction. And sugar causes addiction.
No question. Most people get that now. When I say to audiences, how many of you believe it's addictive? How many of you know firsthand? And people raise their hands. So most people get it.
Yeah. I mean, basically, it's about 20%, I think, of the American population. 40%, you know, I mean, think of it like alcohol, okay? and fructose and alcohol are like virtually identical anyway. So this is a good way to think of it. 40% of Americans are teetotalers. Don't touch the stuff. 40% are social drinkers. You know, can pick up a beer, put it down. You know, we're in that group.
Mm-hmm.
10% of America are binge drinkers. And 10% of America are hardcore bona fide alcoholics. So 20% of people have an alcohol problem. Not everybody, and not everybody who's exposed, but a significant and sizable portion of the American population has a very distinct alcohol problem. Well, guess what? About the same for sugar. About 20%. And you
I'm
know
pretty
who they
surprised
are.
By that, because I feel like my team members always have sugar around, and they're in a total health. I hope they're not listening to this anyway.
Well, you know who they are, because they admit it. They say, "Oh, I have a horrible sweet tooth. That's sugar addiction."
I feel like that's the problem, though. I mean, you hear things like alcoholism and other things, and there's a stigma associated to it, right?
Right.
It's the sugar stuff. It's like, oh, that's okay. I get it.
That's right. Exactly right. So when there's a social stigma associated with it, mm-hmm. then people don't want to own up.
Yeah.
Okay. But with sugar, it's like, because you know what? Everyone's looking for a codependent.
Mm-hmm.
They're looking for somebody to go out and have an ice cream soda with.
Mm-hmm. Yep. Right?
And so, you know, so it's not blatant. I'm sorry. It's not hidden. It's blatant.
Mm-hmm.
One of the issues with this is, you know, we talk about downregulation of dopamine receptors. You know, I always liken this to, you know, the very first taste of an opioid for a drug addict is euphoric, and they're always trying to chase that. And they need more of the drug for less effect. It's the same with sugar, right?
Right.
And we have been manipulated by food manufacturers. Our bliss point, our taste buds are seeking more than ever before. Mm-hmm. And yet there's another biochemical issue. And that is, we have two hunger hormones that regulate our intake. One is called leptin. One is called ghrelin. That's the one that makes your stomach growl. Leptin is the one that it gives you an immediate sense that you've had enough. Those go a little haywire with too much sugar, causing us to just plain flat out eat too much.
Right.
So does, by the way, lack of sleep. And we're sleeping on a whole about an hour and a half less than we did, you know, 50 years ago.
And that raises ghrelin, and also raises cortisol. And cortisol is the stress hormone. And cortisol makes you hungry too. So these things ultimately lead to a vicious cycle. So it is true that ghrelin is the hunger hormone. When your stomach is empty, ghrelin levels are up, basically telling your brain, feed me. Then you eat, and then ghrelin levels go down, and that should be the end of hunger, right? Okay. That should be the end of the meal, right? Wrong. Okay. That's the key. The end of hunger is not the end of the meal. The end of hunger is the end of hunger. Everyone, especially us Americans, okay, can eat through the end of hunger, and routinely do.
Right.
Okay. The end of the meal is a different hormone further down the intestine, because remember, ghrelin's in the stomach. Further down the intestine, at the end of the intestine, in the ileum, is a second hormone called peptide YY3 to 36, or PYY.
Wow.
When the food gets all the way down to the end of the intestine, the cells in the intestine release this hormone called PYY, circulates in the bloodstream, goes to the brain, and the brain goes, oh my God, I'm gonna die. I'm never gonna eat again. I'm totally satiated. Okay, that is the end of the meal. Okay, well, there's 22 feet of intestine between the end of hunger, which is ghrelin, suppression, and the peptide YY increase.
I'm stuffed.
Okay. So end of hunger to I'm stuffed, 22 feet. Takes time.
Yep.
So what I tell people is, you know, wait 20 minutes for second portions. Give your hormones a chance to work. Give your hormones a chance to actually tell your brain what's going on. And if you wait the 20 minutes, you're not going to eat that second portion, because the peptide YY will have kicked in, and you will have saved yourself a whole lot of, you know, extra food that you didn't need or really want, for that matter.
Just as a result of sugar, though, you made a comment, I think it was in Sugar, the Bitter Truth, or it might have been Fat Chance, about how many more calories the average adult and teenager, adolescent child is eating today versus 20 years ago.
Yeah. So adult women.
Because they're hungry, not because they just have stuffed, right?
Yeah, yeah. Adult women are eating 375 calories a day more than they used to. Mm-hmm. Adult men are eating 183 calories a day more than they used to. And teen boys are eating 275 calories a day more than they used to.
Yeah. And now, so a weight gain, a pound is equivalent to...
It's complicated.
Right. I get it.
There are different factors that go into that, but we'll on average about 3,500 calories.
3,500, depending on how much musculature you have in your activity and all of that, right?
That's right. So
yeah, 3,500.
I don't like using that.
I know, I don't either. But if you were to like wonder why we're obese, look at just the calories, and that is not just because the food tastes better, and it's not just about addiction. It's about
what we've learned is that it's not about calories.
Right.
Okay? Calories are the problem. Calories are how we got to this craziness in the first place. Okay. My job is to kill the calorie. Okay. Because calories are simply not a rational unit of measure. Okay. Example why? Almonds. Okay. You eat 160 calories in almonds. How many of those calories do you actually absorb through your intestine into your bloodstream? How many?
A lot of it's fiber and poop it out, right?
Well, so you ate 160, you absorb 130.
Okay.
Now, what happened to the other 30 that you didn't absorb? Well, the fiber in the almonds, the soluble and insoluble fiber, form this barrier we talked about before, preventing early absorption. And therefore, those calories went further down the intestine to the next part of the intestine called the jejunum, after the duodenum, the jejunum. And that's where the bacteria are. And so the bacteria chewed up those 30 calories for their own purposes, not for yours. And you kept them alive. You fed them, which is necessary. And you didn't absorb them, so you actually didn't get them. So even though you ate 160, you actually only got 130. So if you're doing the math, it looks like you should be gaining weight when you're not, when it's almonds. On the other hand, when it's a donut and there's no fiber, okay, you're going to absorb all those calories. So what good is calories? Because calories are measured here at your mouth. Now, if we could measure calories at your intestine, maybe, you know, that would make sense. But we're only measuring calories at the mouth, and that's garbage. Okay, it's just not rational. There are a whole host of reasons why calories don't make sense.
For sure.
And so my job is to kill the calorie as a unit of measure and stop dietitians from talking about calories. Let's talk about, you know, food level of food processing, and then we'll be on to something.
Yeah, if you could, you're not a breakfast eater, but you stop at Starbucks for your caramel frappiano or whatever they are, I don't even know. And you've got that liquid 500 calories. If you were trying to eat 500 calories of broccoli or almonds or celery or anything, like, there's just no way those are created equal. I mean,
exactly right.
Yeah.
So here's an example that my cookbook co-author, Cindy Gershon, always did. She's a nutrition educator in the East Bay. And the first day of every class, okay, this is a lower socioeconomic status school with kids who often haven't even eaten breakfast because of food insecurity. Okay, and so she's teaching them nutrition. And the very first class every single year, she does the same experiment. She takes two kids in the class and she hands the two kids six oranges apiece. And she says to the first kid, "Here, kid, here's six oranges. Make juice." The kid squeezes the six oranges, gets 12 and a half ounces, downs the glass, and says, "Okay, what's for breakfast?" Second kid, she says, to the kid, "Here, kid, here's six oranges. Eat the six oranges." Kid eats orange number one, orange number two.
Starting to get full.
Number three, gets to orange number four and three. throws up. She's got the vomit basin ready because she knows orange number four is the witching orange. Okay. And the kid goes, oh my God, I'm going to die. And then the kid doesn't eat lunch or dinner either.
Right.
So what happened? The fiber happened.
Exactly.
The fiber in the oranges increased transit time. So the satiety signal came sooner. It acted as a barrier. Okay. It generated short chain fatty acids, which are anti-inflammatory and also appetite suppressing. So the bottom line is that the oranges worked and the orange juice didn't.
And there's more micronutrients in the part of the plant that has the fiber. But I like to think of fiber as like straw or hay, because you can picture that. And it absorbs water. Sure. And so if you're hydrating well, it absorbs water and it gets sort of a thick glue-like mass, like a like as if you were to make a smoothie with chia seed or ground flax and leave it on the counter. And you go to pour it in 15 minutes and it's like gelatin. That's what the fiber does in your gut, which is, as Rob said, mitigates or slows the absorption of sugar into the body. And that way our pancreas can keep up by kicking out little bits of insulin in reaction to little bits of sugar, which is how the pancreas was designed.
That's right. That's it. All absolutely true. The only thing that I would add to that is that there are two kinds of fiber. Soluble and insoluble. You need both. Now, real fruit has both. Vegetables have both. But there are these things called Fiber One bars and Fiber One cereal and all sorts of new concoctions out on the shelf that are high in, say, inulin. Okay, these are soluble fiber. Okay, soluble fibers like Metamucil. Okay, and it forms a gel too. But you need the insoluble fiber too, the stringy stuff, okay, the lattice work to basically set up that gel in order to make it more effective. And also the insoluble fiber has benefits of its own, like for instance, improving risk for colon cancer, okay, and also acting as food for that microbiome. So
now that we're on smoothies, I want to ask you another question, because I think a lot of parents say, well, my kids don't eat vegetables or fruit, but I sneak the power greens in or the little powder of greens into their smoothie. And I disguise it with, of course, a banana and some orange juice and some yogurt and some, you know, whatever, some sugar. A spoonful of sugar helps the medicine go down, but we're not getting brain training, right? We're not getting the neuroplasticity of starting to build some right. desire to eat these foods. I also want to ask you about the smoothie in terms of, is it better metabolically for us to chew all that food? Because we're making a very calorie dense drinkable substance.
Right. So I completely agree. When you've destroyed the fiber, you've basically mitigated some of the positive benefits of that fiber in terms of metabolism.
But destroying by blending it, you mean?
Right. Mm-hmm. In addition, for kids and especially for infants and toddlers, and Susan, you're very aware of this, and we've talked about this a zillion times. You actually need to chew. It's required. Babies need to suck and toddlers need to chew. And it's not because that's the only way to get food in, because it's not. There are plenty of pureed foods. The reason they need to do that is because they're growing the airway. The airway.
Really? Just kidding.
Yeah. The airway has to grow along with the infant in order to be able to bring enough oxygen to the rest of the body so that the rest of the body can burn properly. And the airway is the only way oxygen can get in. It's not like it gets absorbed through the skin. It's not like you can put it up your behind. It's got to be breathed in. And so the airway, especially the mouth, okay, has a certain cross-sectional area. And the goal is to make that cross-sectional area as wide as possible in order to conduct more air being able to go through, called Bernoulli's principle. you know, why, you know, pipes, you know, make noise when they're, you know, small and not when they're big.
You know, I'm so happy right now. We have a famous pediatric neuroendocrinologist talking about airway. And I just am like, thank you so much.
Sure. The point is that you need that airway to grow. Well, the airway has this thing in it called the tongue. And the tongue has to make room for itself. And the way the tongue makes room for itself is by pushing on the hard palate, the top of the mouth, in order to spread the incisive suture, in order to increase the size and width of that palatal vault on purpose to make room for itself and also to grow the airway.
Up and forward, the airway, I mean, it's amazing when you look in people's mouths, and if their mouths are retracted, you can't even see the airway. The whole complex is retracted. And so we need that.
Right. And if you don't do that, you end up with a phenomenon which lots of parents know about called malocclusion. And malocclusion means, guess what? Braces. That's a hell of a lot of money. Okay. And the goal is to not need the braces. Another thing that's going to happen is you're not going to have enough room for your wisdom teeth. And so now you've got wisdom tooth extraction, more money out the door. And it turns out that all of those kids with malocclusion and with braces, okay, all end up with obstructive sleep apnea as adults.
It's a slow, slippery slope. And we see it all the time, which is how those of us got into pediatric airways, by seeing our adult patients who are literally slowly dying of the effects of obstructive sleep apnea.
And it's because they can't conduct enough oxygen into their bodies. And this has metabolic detriments called diabetes, heart disease, Alzheimer's disease, etc. So there is a direct path from baby feeding, in fact, fetal feeding even, okay, through early childhood into young adulthood and adult chronic disease. Well, we are giving our kids pureed baby food.
That's not even kids, but like pouches of all kinds for toddlers and older kids.
Exactly.
Sucking instead of chewing.
And it may be convenient, but that's not the issue. The issue is health. And we are basically compromising our babies and infants and toddlers' health right from the start. And this is where parents have to basically, you know, jump on board and say, you know, the health of my kid is the most important thing. And I need to do what's right for my kid, not what's right for, you know, Nestle or Beechnut or any of these other companies.
So the smoothie question has been answered in four different ways. Better to eat real food. And the other thing about it is that you can suck down a smoothie really fast. And it's that same thing about the orange, throwing up on the fourth orange, right? If you were to pile all that food up and ask a child to eat it, he'd never get through it.
Right.
So that's a little bit dangerous in terms of calorie consumption. I'm not saying smoothies are bad. I'm just saying
So number one, smoothies, you've destroyed the insoluble fiber because the blades shear the fiber to smithereens. So now you don't have the insoluble fiber to help make that gel. And in addition, fruit smoothies are very high in sugar. Now, green smoothies, a little less so. But, you know, green smoothies have stuff in it that's bitter. Well, though, that bitter is actually the nucleic acids, the polyphenols, the flavonoids. Those have a slightly bitter taste, but that's the stuff that's good. So what do? We kind of cover it over by adding sugar. And that's what the processed food industry, that's what the baby food industry does. So they add sugar to all of those jarred baby foods very specifically to make the kids eat it. The point is we're setting those kids up to be seeking sugar later on. And the food industry did it in order to basically brand their product upon your kid's brain.
I always say it takes an average of 7 tastes of a food for a child to start to like it. We need to continue. But the 13. Savory foods and the sweet, I was going to say the 13. Savory foods are more, and the sweet foods are pretty fast to like. So we say the average is 7, but you said 13 for savory foods.
13, median of 13 for savory foods, the Monell Chemical Sciences Center in Philadelphia. So median of 13. So bottom line, we have abdicated our responsibility as parents in pursuit of extra time, in pursuit of convenience, in pursuit of cost, in pursuit of coolness. But we have abdicated our responsibility as parents. And if you're going to be a brave parent, you don't abdicate your responsibility.
I absolutely agree with that. I think parents are spending a lot of time feeding kids in cars while they're traveling back and forth to competitive sports events that are 70 miles away, and there's no dinner time. And this whole thing is a little maddening when you start to learn what it takes to raise a healthy child. If it's true that you value health, you got to do what it takes. It's hard.
Well, now, having said that, okay, a lot of parents are afraid to let their kids out of their sights for fear of crime.
Yeah, I know.
So the stress of our current, shall we say, societal debacle, you know, weighs heavily on parents. And all you have to do is turn on the news, you know, like today. I don't want to timestamp our talk here today, but they just sentenced, you know, the Parkland shooter, you know, to life in prison without parole. You know, and they sent their kid to school thinking everything was going to be fine, and then it wasn't. I mean, our society has major problems, but if you give in to those problems, you have not done your child a service.
I agree with that too. It's a really tough time.
It is
a really tough time.
It's a tough time to be a parent, and that's why you have to be brave.
Very tough. I do, tongue surgery on babies to get them to latch so we can grow a bigger tongue box. And I see these young parents all the time, and they might be in their 20s, and said, you know, recently said, you know what? It's just so hard to raise kids these days compared to when I was a kid. And I'm like, what are you? You are a kid to me. But, you know, as in our age saying, it's so different, but it's changed in 20 years so much in terms of the difficulties in parenting and how hard it is to raise healthy kids.
Indeed. So it is. And that's why you wrote your book. Mm-hmm. And that's why I wrote my book, is basically to give parents the tools they need in order to be able to, you know, sort of manage, you know, our current society, you know, which is basically turned on them. And, you need tools, you need skills, and you need the knowledge in order to be able to, you know, create your own environment, not the one that they chose for you.
I would recommend all of you listeners to take a look at all three of Rob's books. And for me, I couldn't put them down. And, you know, it's his passion shines through. You are a gift to my spirit, my friend, and I am so grateful.
Vice
you know
versa,
how much I adore you.
Vice versa, young lady.
Thank you. We'll keep on going. I loved speaking at the Swedish Metabolic Conference with you, by the way. That was really fun. Really fun. Well, a dream come true for me. The keynote speaker somehow didn't show up. And so Rob and I were pinch hitters and spoke about pediatric microbiome with very little advanced preparation. And it was a blast. So a lifelong memory.
Rob, I can tell you as a parent, this has been incredibly informational and super helpful. I did have a quick question with one of your three books. Is one of those a cookbook? Because you did mention a cookbook author.
So I have many books, but yes, there is a cookbook. It is called Pat Chan's Cookbook. Perfect. And 140 recipes, every single one of them vetted by a Mount Diablo high school student to be producible, consumable, and delicious in 30 minutes or less. All extremely no sugar on purpose. Okay. And the most complicated piece of equipment you need is a blender.
I love it.
It's
buying it as soon as we're off of this. So that's perfect.
Thank you. Say hi to your family for me. I look forward to talking to you again soon. And I appreciate all that you had to go through to even carve out an hour for us today. I mean, just so grateful.
My pleasure, Susan. You know that always.
Thank you. Thanks. We'll talk soon. Thank you for listening to the Brave Parent Podcast with your host, Dr. Susan Maples, author of Brave Parent, and Lauren Eckert, founder of Burning Soul Press. Be sure to leave a podcast review and grab your copy of Brave Parent on Amazon or Audible or wherever you choose to buy your books. Bye for now.